Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a Retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Welcome to our first episode of 2024. For this episode, we bring you a preview of the January 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online and in print at retinalphysician.com. For this episode, we focus on a few topics from this latest issue. This was an issue focusing mostly on imaging, but we did start with a discussion of a controversy of when should you withdraw anti-VEGF therapy in wet age-related macular degeneration. We then discussed imaging biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease and then imaging and artificial intelligence applications for age-related macular degeneration. Thanks to Drs. Lidiana Godini, Josh Ewer, and Sarwar Zahid for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can claim CME credits for older episodes by clicking on the link in the podcast description. And we always include some relevant financial disclosures in the episode description as well. Hope you enjoy.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with the first episode of 2024. This is the preview of the January 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. And Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com as well as in print. I'm joined by three of my friends from around the country in alphabetical order. First, Dr. Lidiana Godini is in Cleveland. Lidiana, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Josh Ewer is in Philadelphia. Josh, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Sarwar Zahid is in the great city of New York. Sarwar.
Thank you, Jay. It's great to be back.
So we got four great articles to discuss. As always, you can read these articles to their completion online. I'll just do a brief summary and takeaway points. I'm using them as jumping off points for discussion. First one is called Withdrawal of Anti-VEGF Agents in Neovascular AMD. Should it be a goal? So Michael Colicello, he does this series of controversies where he essentially brings up a topic and he'll ask two different authors to sort of weigh in on two sides. You know, sometimes debate type articles or panels can feel a little artificial, but I think he's done a really good job of picking topics where there are reasonable, logical arguments on both sides. And I think that this is a very interesting discussion, right? So they talk about something called treat and stop. So most of us are familiar with treat and extend, where we treat with anti-VEGF for example, neovascular AMD. And then you keep extending the intervals. Well, the question is, if you reach a point at which the intervals reach X number, and they said 12 weeks, for example, and they are inactive, do you stop treating at some point? And so there are some things that are discussed as pros and cons at either side of the argument. You know, they talk about, you know, withdrawal could be a problem, right? In terms of CNV reactivation and potential for hemorrhage and exudation. Overtreating could be an issue, not just in terms of patient burden, rare risks of infection with injection, but also in terms of maybe you worsen GA, maybe there's issues in terms of treating too much. And we have Dr. Anat Lowenstein, who talks about the treat, extend, stop protocol. And this was based on some data she cited from Adrian et al. They found that only 9.9% of a study population over 8 years lost three lines or more. And this was agnostic to anti-VEGF utilized, which is very interesting. Their protocol was three monthly injections of an anti-VEGF. And then if the macula is free, they kept extending until you got to 12 weeks. I think we're all familiar with that. The patient had at least seven injections and three consecutive 12 weeks without exudation. Injections were stopped, and then they were seen fairly frequently 1 month later and successfully longer by two-week intervals to extend back to sort of treat, not an observe and extend sort of interval to see how they did after that. And they cite several other studies. And it's interesting, Anat Lowenstein is someone who's interesting to talk about this because she's also talked about home monitoring and OCT at home, and that kind of ties into this idea a little better. Diana Doe comes in talking about disease activity and talking about undertreatment, talking about the issue in terms of loss of vision with undertreatment, and again, the risks and benefits of 12 versus 16, you know, or even more extension versus stopping completely. So we'll go in alphabetical order. So Lidiana, you heard both sides of this argument. In your practice, like, do you ever stop treatment in a patient? I think we all stop treatment in situations, for example, where someone may not gain vision. Someone has count fingers or discoform scar. I would view that as a little different, though some people still continue to treat those patients. We can talk about that separately. I'm talking about a patient who has good vision, who has shown that they've had wet AMD. Will you ever stop treatment in those patients, or do you extend out? And what is sort of your maximum extension interval?
So I think the scenario you mentioned is this far in my career is the only patients that I've stopped. There's a couple patients I have with discoform scars, and we got to like 16 weeks and they're count fingers, and you know, they weren't seeing any benefit from injection. So we stopped and I'm monitoring those. I have not stopped any anti-VEGF in patients who remain, who retain good vision. And I talked to them about that when we start, because they all ask like, how long am I going to do this? And basically I tell them it's most likely long-term and possibly lifelong treatment, because there's no way for us to get rid of the disease. And our goal is to control the lesion and not necessarily, you know, stop treatment. I think there's certain patients that are now out to like 16 weeks and they look great. And I've actually talked to them about stopping, but they're kind of afraid, like, or, you know, not like suggested stopping, but I've said, you know, you haven't had an injection in 16 weeks. We can go to 18 weeks. The other alternative is we can skip an injection, have you come back in 4 weeks and see how you do, but there's a risk that you could reactivate. And actually no one has wanted to do that. I have a couple of patients like that, and I don't know, I haven't gotten a sense from them. I think at that point, they're kind of gotten used to the injections, especially if they've had a significant improvement in the vision that they don't want to stop. So I haven't, and I don't really tell people that the goal is to stop if they have good vision.
So Sarwar, letting out seeing these nice Midwesterners who, you know, follow the rules and they look both ways before they cross the street. You know, they don't turn left on a yellow. They'll wait for the light to turn green again. So let's go to New York, Sarwar, in your clinical practice. What do you do and what do your patients prefer, right? Do you ever extend to 4 months, 6 months in terms of treating? Do you ever treat and stop? And I guess to take this one question further is, you know, Adrian's paper that was cited here, essentially one out of 10 patients in the series at 8 years lost 3 lines or more. So if you believe that data, you would say that you need to treat 10 patients to save one patient from losing vision in 8 years, over 8 years. Do you think that number to treat is something justifiable? I think you can argue both sides of that.
Personally, I would say yes. So I actually similarly only definitely stop treatment if there's a macular scar and there's no improvement to be had. Sometimes, you know, if there's a question of whether or not completely drying the macula can maximize the vision, because there is a difference between a count fingers eye with subretinal hemorrhage versus the absence of subretinal hemorrhage. But aside from that, I don't like the idea of stopping treatment completely. Definitely not for monocular patients. I maintain those patients on Q 3 to 4 months. What's interesting is, you know, the article nicely talks about the protocols, like 3 monthly injections, and then you extend by 1 to 2 weeks. A lot of my colleagues, myself included, start extending a little bit earlier, especially with some of our newer medications that are a little bit longer lasting. I mean, I know the Vabysmo label is a little bit different, but I actually start extending these patients a little bit early. If the subretinal fluid is completely dry at 1 month, I say, you know what, let's try 5 to 6 weeks. You know, let's find the sweet spot. We don't know what the sweet spot is. And I don't know if people are necessarily always doing the same protocol described here with starting with at least 3 injections. If a patient has good vision, I don't know which patient is going to reactivate. And the thing is, these patients often have other illnesses. You know, it's really hard to predict when the recurrence would occur, what exactly is causing it to occur. Some people talk about a second CNV. So I actually continue to extend them out. I extend out to 4 months and then 5 months and 6 months. And at that point, you know, enough time has gone by that, all right, you know, you're good for 6 months. The tough thing is, if you, in the protocols described in this article, if you do 3 straight injections every 3 to 4 months, you know, you haven't pushed. I mean, that's why I really like treat and extend, because it helps you find that sweet spot. And I actually haven't stopped unless there's poor visual potential in the eye.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, Josh, you can talk about this too, like the monthly injection thing, right? So most trials, there's some people argue you should follow the label or follow the trial, and the label and the trial always say monthly injections. I'm actually like Sarwar. I mean, it depends on the clinical scenario, right? So if you have a patient who's got severe exudation, hemorrhage, I'm more likely, and I think Sarah would agree, to be monthly until the hemorrhage is gone. But some of these patients have just a tiny amount of fluid. They're 20/25. You're trying to get ahead of it, but you're not as concerned. If they dry up right away with one injection, then sometimes you're like, well, do you really have to do it in a month if that day is the day after Christmas? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe you kind of move it around. You know, Josh,
I do that thoughts? Too.
Yeah. Josh, thoughts on that, or and then thoughts on this paper and the idea of stopping. Do you ever stop treatment in patients who have good vision?
You know, I agree with Sarwar and Lediana. I really only stop if people are sort of have reached that sort of floor in terms of what their visual potential is, you know, discoform scar and count fingers. In terms of stopping with good vision, I really don't. And I know that the ADREAM study cites a rate of about 10% of recurrence, but there's such a wide range in the literature. There's another study quoted in this paper that showed that in a series of patients that had inactive CNVM for at least 3 months on consecutive visits and for whom treatment was discontinued, there was a 91% recurrence rate at 18 months in that cohort. So, you know, the studies range from 10% to 90% for recurrence rate. So that does make me, you know, nervous to stop. As Sarwar was saying, you don't know who's going to recur. And unfortunately, you don't know who's going to have a large subretinal hemorrhage, right? So if someone recurs and there's a little bit of macular edema, a little bit of fluid, and you can gain vision back just by reinitiating injections, probably not a big deal. But for that patient who has a large hemorrhage and loses, you know, vision that's unrecoverable, that's I think that's something that we can potentially avoid with even infrequent injections. You know, if you're doing Q16 week injections, it's a handful of injections a year. Yeah, it's still a burden. There's still risks, but you're going to be seeing those patients anyway to monitor. Right? They're going to be in your office anyway. So the risks of injections are relatively low. We're all comfortable doing them. I just think it's worth giving them that maintenance therapy if their vision is good.
So let's move on to a discussion more about diagnosis. So this is retinal biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. Retinal imaging metrics have the potential to provide valuable insights. Sharon Beckwith, senior author, Meredith Cox was the first author. I think this is a topic we've heard a lot about, and Sharon's group has done a lot in the past in terms of increasing the knowledge regarding how you can use biomarkers and retinal imaging to look at Alzheimer's disease. So one of the things they talk about, which again has come up before, it's very difficult to diagnose Alzheimer's with quantitative data. There are cognitive status testings that you can do. You can do spinal taps, but obviously that may not be the most advisable. It's very invasive. And you can look at certain patterns on brain imaging. But again, there's not really a great way to pick it up early. And a lot of this is about early detection, especially very similar to GA. Now in the Alzheimer's community, there's discussion of can you do things at early to prevent disease progression. And they talk about that there is a preclinical asymptomatic stage, probably 15 to 20 years, which is a little scary. You know, if you're going to get Alzheimer's at 70, that means the four of us in this call aren't far off if one of us got Alzheimer's from being someone who's in that preclinical stage. Maybe I'm the closest. I don't mean Sarwar, maybe they're closest. But so like when I think about this paper, right, they talk about OCT, they talk about OCTA. They talk about some of the biomarkers that have been associated. And one of them is vessel density in the superficial plexus. Obviously, there are confounders in the face of concomitant disease. We know there are other diseases that can affect this, but they do talk about that if you look at twin studies, that the twin with Alzheimer's disease has lower vessel densities and a larger FAZ in the superficial capillary plexus, which is very, very interesting that they were able to find twins, first of all, to do this. But it is fascinating to think about that. And they do see that there's no real difference if you look at patients who get Alzheimer's early versus late. And so the clinical applications, right, and I've been in discussions about this, is if you can pick up these things sooner, all these drugs that are in trial, anything that's in trial to try to help patients with Alzheimer's disease, maybe you could use retinal biomarkers to assess risk and stratify and do what you need to do in terms of doing proper enrollment. They do talk about AI, which I think we're going to get to AI a little later. I think, again, what they say is we talk a lot about retinal disease burden, Josh, and we'll kind of circle back. There's obviously diseases outside of retina that we just don't talk about because we're so super specialized, but there is a huge exponential rise in patients with Alzheimer's. We have an aging population. This is something that is going to be a public health issue, has been, has continued to be a public health issue. We want to support these patients, and you want to support Sarwar and I as we move further into our elder years. So I guess one of the big things here, Josh, is I think there's progression. I think it's good to get an update on this. I thought some of the data here was really interesting. Was there any part of this that really stood out to you as being like, oh, that seems very, very promising?
Yeah, you know, I think, so they talk about multiple different imaging OCT biomarkers that are indicative of Alzheimer's. And there are some of these biomarkers that are pretty consistent across studies that are related to Alzheimer's disease. But there's also a lot of inconsistency with some of these. So I think that overall, the potential for using retinal imaging to screen for Alzheimer's is promising. And as you said, it's going to be an increasing public health burden. But I kind of took away from this that it's not fully ready for prime time, because a lot of the kind of incongruity in the results of different studies is something we don't really know yet how to interpret and what to make of it. And the other thing is, you know, if you're screening large swaths of the population that's potentially at risk for Alzheimer's disease, how do you fit that into your clinic? How do you practically use these biomarkers? I mean, these are things that are not necessarily easy to measure with the technology that most of us have in our clinics. I think there's some challenges to using this, using retinal imaging, although I certainly think that there's a lot of promise here if some of those challenges can be addressed and to make this something that we can practically use in our clinics.
Sara, what do you think?
I agree. I don't think it's ready for prime time. It was interesting to see a lot of these markers, such as vessel density, superficial and deep capillary plexus density. You know, there's a lot of literature that has shown correlations with progressing diabetic retinopathy. But I think it also shows the fact that, we're looking at, vessel branching patterns in the retinal periphery in opto. So I think this is something that's definitely needed because there's a approved FDA-approved, very expensive medication for dementia that was approved, I think, within the last couple of years, controversial because it's very expensive and the way the data was presented for FDA approval. But, the hope is that we do have some effective treatments. But even in the absence of effective treatments, there are things that have been shown to at least ward off dementia from mild cognitive impairment. And I have these conversations like every couple of days with my parents. I'm like, dude, you gotta keep your mind active, go work out. And, if we can at least identify the patients who are at higher risk, we can make an effort at least before we have the treatments to change some of these behavioral things. And we also know that, even when there's mild cognitive impairment, sometimes there's, things that happen, in self-care that deteriorate. And, maybe there's less control of, maybe a poorer diet or poor high diabetes or blood pressure control, which can add to a component of vascular dementia. So we definitely want, and some of these things are very easy to analyze because we already have the software to analyze vessel density patterns. So, but the thing is, how do we show that we can catch these at an early enough stage to make a clinical difference? And I think Josh made a great point that, we just need bigger studies. And it's nice to have some of these older data sets to, to analyze, but we can also do it prospectively, knowing that it's an aid that, hey, you even telling a patient, hey, you may have a small increased risk of dementia. So, coming from a retina specialist, it's like, hey, go for a walk. I mean, I tell my patients to go for a walk and not just going up or down the stairs in their house all the time. And sometimes they come back and tell me yeah, I actually went for a walk and it wasn't just to go. I just walked for no reason. I'm started doing this now, So I don't know. Hopefully we can make a difference there.
I feel like I need to start walking more. Lidiana, what do you think? Any final thoughts on this one?
I agree with what Josh and Star Wars said. I think we need obviously a lot more research into this. The other thing is, they looked at, I assume, healthy controls versus Alzheimer's patients. When we have patients in our retina clinic, there's a lot of, retinal pathology. So it, we have to find ways to differentiate whether some of these changes are due to linked to Alzheimer's or if they're due to other reasons for neurocognitive decline or, other retinal pathology that could result in, these abnormal findings that may be similar to patients with Alzheimer's. So I think these things also have to be kind of sorted out, because we don't just see healthy controls in our clinic. So, and then if this tool does become available, where will it go for screening? Will it be in ophthalmology clinics where some patients have pathology that might confound the results? Will it be in primary care offices, will be in neurology offices. So, I think lots to be ironed out, but I do think it's really interesting because our retinal technology is so advanced and we have the ability to see, you know, individual vessels and individual layers of the retina. And I think it's great that we have such advanced technology that we can hopefully sort this out. And like Sarwar and Josh said, detect these patients early on to hopefully reduce the disease burden of Alzheimer's on both, you know, society and also the family members and the caregivers. You know, they mentioned here it's caused billions of dollars for caregivers and for society. So I think it's a great, you know, like I think we're making great strides. It just has more, you know, more to go.
Yeah, I would say the final point, and you guys brought up this point, I think the hard part is once it gets severe enough, how are you going to, OCTA has its own limitations in terms of capture, right? So there's many things that, if that is your screening tool, then it's not a fast screening tool. It's faster than a lot of screening tools, but there are, it's not, we're not at a point yet to say, and Star Wars said it's not ready for prime time. We're not at a point yet where you can automate it and someone just sits down and gets OCTA and moves on, because the image quality can vary so greatly because you need so many scans to be obtained. And again, as the technology gets better, maybe it'll be less of an issue. Let's talk about insightful imaging for geographic atrophy. So this is by Brian Selinsky with the senior author, Monica Fleckenstein, Steven Schmitz of Laukenberg. So this is, GA is obviously a hot topic, and we can talk about GA. It's interesting to move on from Alzheimer's to GA, because I often think about them similarly in terms of the counseling, the medications, things like that. And they just kind of go through the different imaging modalities to go. And the main ones, again, still color photography, fundus autofluorescence, OCT, and angiography, right? These are still sort of the mainstays, although there's new things coming around. But there's evolution. You know, a color photography used to be kind of, they talk about it as the gold standard. And I think it's still helpful. I think I like color photos periodically in AMD patients, right? It's useful for monitoring. But many of people are moving to fundus autofluorescence because it can show you more information about where the lesions are likely to develop. We know a lot about prediction based on fundus autofluorescence of different areas of hyper and hypoautofluorescence, where you're going to have more problems. Fundus autofluorescence, I think, was not as ubiquitous in our clinic. Sorry, and you can talk a little about reimbursement. Maybe like part of that is because it's not like you get much more for doing an FAF or a photo, right? It's kind of on the same coding spectrum. And then you have OCT and OCTA and fluorescein angiography. And again, one of the limitations of OCTA financially is you don't get to bill beyond an OCT. And that shouldn't define what you should do as good for the patient, but it does make real impacts in terms of how things are applied in the clinic. You know, they talk at the end, I think this is a useful review, that not everything is AMD. And I think we've all seen patients who are diagnosed with AMD at a very young age and should immediately trigger red flags. It's probably not AMD. Or patients who are diagnosed with severe AMD one eye and the other eye is completely normal. And that usually is not AMD either. Just remembering there can be hereditary things that can look, just because you have macular atrophy lesions does not mean that there's GA. They actually talk about it's pretty rare to have any sort of GA before the age of 70, unless, so Lediana, like I think we've talked before about practice flow patterns and what's changed. And I think that some people have said, like, for example, with injectables for GA, they'll get imaging more often, et cetera, et cetera. I think that it's still like, I still don't talk to that many people who are getting useful information on a day-to-day basis from FAF. Like, I feel it does happen in academic centers. It does happen with very diligent providers. If you're talking about the thousands of retina specialists in the United States, you know, people may be acquiring FAF images, but, you know, interpreting them and comparing them and seeing differences over time, unless it's very spread, I think we're still not great as a community democratically spread in terms of our knowledge base, in terms of how to like apply it. I don't know how you guys use it in your practice. And I think Sarwar and I talked about this the last time he was on. I think this is where AI would play a big role, because I think anytime you have an imaging modality, we're looking for very, very fine changes and you're trying to compare images. And it's not like OCT where it overlays as you can see the difference. Like, that's where I think there's role for maybe more automation to show you exactly what's going on at the lesion level.
So I actually do get fundus autofluorescence on GA patients. I mean, obviously you can see the lesions on your exam. The reason I like it is because I think it makes the conversation a little bit easier with the patient. I think trying to explain GA based on an OCT scan is really difficult. And sometimes it's hard for them to look at a fundus photo and kind of like distinguish really what the GA area is. So I think it makes it really easy to explain to them what the GA is, where the center is, and what we're trying to do. If they are interested in therapeutics, what we're trying to do. So I think it just makes it much easier for them to grasp their disease and what our goal is. So I like it for that reason. I think it's also sometimes helps you in patients that are a little bit more difficult to examine, or if they're you know, light sensitive, it can help you pick up like smaller GA lesions you might have not necessarily seen if you just do a quick look at the slit lamp. And the other thing you said is just to make sure that it really is GA and nothing else, no other reason for macular atrophy, especially in those patients that are kind of like borderline, like late 60s, you know, that are, I guess, close to being 70, but they have some GA, just to make sure they don't have, you know, Stargardt's or something else. So I like it for all those reasons. And I actually do get it, I would say, if it's available at the clinic that I'm at. If we have autofluorescence, I will get it on my, you know, new GA consults for all those reasons. I'm not sure how often I'm going to repeat it, you know, since this is like so new and the therapeutics are so new, but maybe like repeat it yearly just to see like how the lesions have progressed to kind of show the patient. But yeah, I haven't decided how often to do a fundus autofluorescence after the baseline. I do get OCT on every single visit though.
Sarwar, what do you do for your imaging? I mean, OCT every visit, FAF every 6 months. Rinse, repeat, throw in some geographic atrophy and medication and some of these, I mean, like what do you view as the optimal sort of workflow pattern?
I also, it's just easier to do OCT every single time because that's our main imaging modality. I actually, at my office, at least, I have, you know, as long as the office, clinic is not too busy, I get a autofluorescence and I just don't bill for it unless I'm utilizing it. It's mostly just to show the patient. And I think that's the hardest part because, and I think this is the article makes a good point about blue autofluorescence versus green autofluorescence. I don't have the Heidelberg, I don't have blue autofluorescence. I have the Optos autofluorescence. And I, you know, want to know that those are, you know, comparable because we were not necessarily imaging the exact same thing. Yes, you see GA lesions, but a lot of these recent studies used blue autofluorescence. I want to make sure that I'm not using something that is giving me less information. What I actually end up doing, because we're all having these conversations because of the recent approval of complement inhibitors. What I end up doing is something I wish AI did for me, as you mentioned. I'm sitting there with an OCT, actually lining it up, because as great as the auto tracking is in the Heidelberg software, sometimes it's a little bit off. I'm like, all right, I'm right at the bottom half of the nerve there. We're in the same location. Let me measure out the area of RPE hypertransmission defect into the choroid. It's like, hey, look, this has grown by 40 microns since the last visit, and this may get larger. You know, this is why, you know, we should have a conversation with your family about these medications. But that is extremely time consuming. And some days I'm like, you know, at my other job, it's like 50 to 60 patients. And, you know, it's really hard. I mean, I do it, but, you know, then I end up paying for it later in the day. So I really want some more FDA approved tools because it'll help us as more therapeutics come into play.
Josh, Sarwar didn't talk about reimbursement, even though I tried to serve it to him on a platter. He didn't really get into it much. Sorry. And I appreciate you zagging because it's okay. It keeps me on my toes. Josh, like the financial part of it, right? Like, and that factors into flow, and it shouldn't, but as reimbursements decline and you have to sort of prioritize how you flow, I don't think adding an autofluorescence for a patient really slows things down. It's added cost without added reimbursement, but they're usually, most of the cameras thankfully can do both. Either they can do the OCT and the FAF, or can do the fundus photo and the FAF at the same time. OCTA, do you have it? Do you use it? Do you use it in GA patients at all? How often do you order an OCTA?
Yeah, you know, we do have it. I use it occasionally. I don't use it for GA, but I use it really for patients who I think may have some subtle trace, you know, subretinal fluid, there's drusen, there's a PED. I'm not sure if it's early conversion to neovascular AMD. So I get it to see if it helps. Although I have to be honest, I haven't been that impressed with our OCTA software that I have. I have patients who clearly have wet AMD, you know, and who respond well to injections, and I get an OCTA on them, and I haven't, you know, clearly seen a CNVM on the OCTA. So I limit my use of it because I don't know how much I should trust it. That said, I don't really use it in GA. If I have no concern for neovascular AMD, I'm not getting it.
Yeah, I think the other issue, and Sarah brought this up in the chat. I think that OCTA interpretation is also not fast either. And I'm not saying it's not a reason to get it, but if it's slow to acquire, it's not always great image quality, you can't bill more for it, and it's tough to interpret in some situations, unless you have experience looking at a lot, it's going to be really hard to get widespread adoption. And again, we've been talking about this for 4, 5, 6 years, Star Wars. It doesn't seem like there's a new code on the horizon, you know, in terms of splitting the codes. I know you've done some advocacy work, but like that's something that's been discussed, and it seems like there's not much traction in that arena.
When it comes to reimbursement, it would be nice if we had an autofluorescence code that was not bundled with OCT, unfortunately. So I was just putting this in the chat, actually. I think a reasonable methodology for some of these patients, because if we're talking about GA, we're seeing these patients every 3 to 4 months. It depends. If they have GA and you're not doing anything about it, I mean, I'm still seeing them, monitoring them every 3 to 4 months for neovascularization, assuming we're not doing any other treatment. If you're seeing them a bit more often, you can alternate your billing, your OCT and the fundus photo, because, you know, with that, you're getting a autofluorescence as well. It's basically, that's where you're getting it. But unfortunately, there's no, you know, I don't see a solution for that, because, you know, from an advocacy standpoint, I mean, at this point, we're just trying to prevent another like 3 to 5% cut from the sequester. So, you know, before we even get to the point when we're saying like, hey, you know, the rep committee, we need a new code for fundus autofluorescence, you know, they're, you know, the entire team is trying to fight off these annual cuts, you know. And I think that's unfortunately, from an advocacy standpoint, that's where some of these other issues that we would like take a backseat to fighting reimbursements, fighting the drop in the physician fee schedule. And I think everyone, I mean, you know, yeah, I think we've talked about this a bit before. If we can peg it to inflation so that we're not fighting the sequester every single year, like, I'm sick of these like emails, let's send these mass emails to our representatives, call our representatives. It's like, we're always on the back foot there. So, you know, to anybody who's listening, there's a bill in the House right now that has bipartisan support that would peg the physician fee schedule to inflation, so we're not getting sequestered and taking the hit from inflation, which was particularly bad these last 18 months or so.
Let's end on a slightly less somber note than talking about reimbursement. AI to manage the AMD burden. This is by William Hasseltine and Kim Hazel. Again, we'll run through this quickly. They go through about what machine learning is, and if you haven't read about machine learning, like how it works in terms of taking large data sets, observing patterns, and then being used diagnostically to detect disease. And then they talk about like the different models that you could use, right? And so the AI models are going to get better exponentially over time. They're going to get used exponentially over time. One of the problems, again, is you need to have the databases. So one of the things they talk about with like the AREDS database, we use that a lot for a lot of our studies. The AREDS database has old pictures, and these old pictures are not necessarily the highest quality, and you're not giving the machine something to learn off of that is applicable to what they may learn today. I would equate it to trying to teach a machine to use an abacus when you have a calculator. Like, you have better technology available now, so you really need databases of the images the machine is going to actually be looking at, apples to apples sort of comparison. And so they do talk in the last section about, does it work? And there's a lot of studies that have come out. They cite some of these papers. They talk about an AI platform that was on par for diagnosis of AMD with skilled retinal specialists. So guys, keep your other hobbies and interests available. If you're out there, you may never know whether the AI will take over, but you know, the progression rate can also be predicted. And these are very, very early versions of this, right? And I think we know this with computer technology, that it's never the first, second, or third version. If you showed someone today the original iPhone, they would look at you and be like, that is like the worst thing ever, right? But things keep changing. And Sarah, you bring up the point, they're all about 90% accurate. You know, where's the other 10%, right? Is that the human intuition? Like, what will a retina specialist be doing in 15 or 20 years diagnostically that AI could not do?
I think I agree. They're all 90%. I think it's such a hot topic, you know, and I feel like, you know, there's always articles about it, and all these articles are somehow, you know, every single algorithm is like, you know, replacing a retina specialist. But I think there's so much nuance to it. I mean, you know, we just talked about all the different imaging modalities and how, you know, a lot of doctors struggle with OCTA. And even, you know, looking at a straight up fundus photo, you know, it depends on the choroidal pigmentation and, you know, depending on what your imaging modality is. You know, there's nuance to it. And I still think, you know, because of the nuance, I still think we'll have our jobs because I think the one thing that these AI algorithms may not have, they might have deep learning and, you know, all this great technology, but they don't necessarily have the nuance and the body of experience that we have. You know, they can't necessarily look at an image and be like, oh, actually this smells kind of hereditary. Let me call Spark or Blueprint. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I think we have nuance. So I'm less concerned about AI. Bring it, you know?
Josh, I mean, I do a lot of diagnostic checks now because I supervise accounting clinics. So a lot of times I'm just going in diagnostically to take a look at things as the only retina specialist look at things, give it. And a lot of this is also based on experience, pattern recognition, things that an AI could do. I would say that where we will be important, at least diagnostically, is for the things you can't image, especially. And we just talked about Alzheimer's patients. There's a whole host of patients you can't effectively image. And until we have a machine that learns how to hold an indirect and to capture an image on every patient, I actually think not to be in a worst case, quote unquote, best case, worst case, it's great, I think, actually, for patient care. Like, there are always in my mind going to be some people who the imaging is not going to be able to be something they can sit at the machine or they have the media to be examined. And that's where the machine is going to run into problems, even as the cameras get better and better.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. I mean, there's always going to be patients who will not be able to sit in front of a camera or peripheral pathology. I mean, I know that's not the purpose of AI, but peripheral pathology will be something that I think AI will be very challenged in terms of being able to capture. So, you know, those are challenges to AI. The other thing that this article talks about is that a lot of these AI algorithms are intended to look for specific diseases like macular degeneration. So you could teach a computer software program to recognize AMD, but patients come to the eye doctor and we do a complete exam, right? So if this algorithm is looking for drusen or fluid or whatever it's trained to look at, it could miss glaucoma or something else. So not to say that these algorithms can't adapt for that in the future, but who knows? I mean, maybe they'll be so sensitive and pick up all kinds of things. We'll be busier than ever with these referrals that we're getting from them.
Yeah. Lidiana, any final thoughts as someone who sees a lot of these referrals?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with what Josh and Star Wars said. I think that, like Josh said, that right now they're trained to look at one disease at a time. And like we were just talking about the imaging for GA, there's other reasons for like macular atrophy, let's say. So let's say they detect an atrophic lesion. You know, that patient might not necessarily have age-related macular degeneration. They might have some other reason for macular atrophy. And I think one point that the paper brought up is that they're only as good as the data on which you train them. And they're trained on limited data from the IRID study, which I mean is great and has a ton of pictures. But as a specialist, as a retina specialist, you know, we are diagnostically trained on not just, you know, reading literature and books and articles, but seeing hundreds and thousands of patients in person. And I don't think that you can replace that necessarily, you know, as a specialist. So right now, I think we're still okay. So unless AI can have all that aggregate experience that we have, you know, just from the literature and real life experience, I think it'll be useful for certain things, but I certainly don't think it can replace us right now. I like parts of, I mean, you know, certainly promising things like the question of progression. I like that they talked about the one part where the iPredict software predicted the 2-year risk of progression to late AMD with really high accuracy, over 84 and 86%. And I think those are the questions that it could be really useful at. I mean, a lot of patients will say, where will I be in 1 or 2 years? And
right,
you can
right.
give them some averages and you can tell them, you know, based on, you know, average progression, this is where you might be, but everybody's different. We know that there's fast progressors and slow progressors and, you know, the presence of reticular pseudodrusen or other imaging features like, you know, reticular pseudodrusen and other imaging features that might confer a higher risk of progression to certain patients. And I think it could be really useful to answer, you know, those kind of questions, like a specific question for a specific patient based on their imaging. And I think it will be really valuable for those questions, you know, sooner than it will be for, you know, replacing us, which I hope is, you know, far away.
Well, I appreciate you guys taking the time. Lidiana, Josh, Sarwar, thanks for recording this for the holidays. Happy holidays and best wishes for 2024.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Jay.
Many thanks to our team for joining us for this episode. And listeners, remember you can find all of our episodes archived online at retinapodcast.com. It's RTINAPodcast.com. This is episode 416. You can find all of our episodes online on our website, also in the podcast app on your Apple or Android device. Thank you for listening. Thank you for what you do on a daily basis. Thanks for the articles you read and publish. Thanks for the conversations you inspire here each week. Remember, you can always reach out and give us ideas for new episodes, give us feedback by clicking on the contest link on our website or emailing us directly at retsinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Vinacosta for everything they do behind the scenes for the podcast. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.